And a sequential order of the 4 weeks of Advent to prepare us for the Nativity of the Lord, Christmas, this is what they call Gaudete Sunday, or Rejoice Sunday. And the rose candle is lit. It's a time of rejoicing, anticipation, expectation, mild penance, and an examination of that word joy. I've put an etymological breakdown, if you use the word joy as an acronym, what it means. It's also good to realise that joy is a God-given gift. You need the God factor to partake of joy. It's simple, really. Pleasure is for the body, happiness for the heart, and joy for the spirit. How often do we seek pleasure on a hot day by a cool drink? Or if we're hungry, we desire that food. All bodily desires at a sensate pleasure level, and rightfully so. But then we move up a level. Happiness comes from the heart and from persons. Persons give happiness, not pleasure. And it's relationships that foster and form those personal bonds. And of course, we think about all those happy moments in our life. It might have been a past Christmas or an anniversary or some celebration in our families, or just Christmas itself. It's the gathering of people that makes it meaningful and gives happiness to the heart. But then again, there's the soul, and the soul desires not pleasure, not happiness, but joy. And joy is a spiritual factor that comes from God, and joy comes from Him alone. Joy, happiness, and pleasure can all align on certain occasions, such as a nuptial wedding. We are joyful in the Lord because the sacrament is being downloaded from heaven to earth. We are united as family, hence we're happy, and we have certain physical pleasures in delightful dress and decorum and food. And so too, Christmas, if it's a true Christmas, involves all three. We take joy in the birth of our Saviour. We are united, happy as family, at least we hope so, and we put up with each other. And thirdly, we delight in the pleasures of the body, a nice ale and some great pudding and so forth. We are called to live and love in that threefold manner. The problem, however, comes when we short-circuit the system. And rather than seeking joy, we exchange joy of the spirit for happiness of the heart. We give up on God to focus on family and at the expense of God, and we lose out. Or when we seek pleasures of the body from a person and we pull the level from the heart, happiness, down to the body, and we use others. So that's when we short circuit, we fail to exchange, or rather, we exchange a higher good for a lower pleasure. And that's a mistake to make, and we know that deep within our heart. So we seek joy at this time of year, and this joyful Sunday, because joy itself comes from God. And unlike pleasures of the body that linger, no, they don't linger at all, they're here and gone. Once you've quenched your thirst, it's finished. Once you've had that great steak, it's gone. Happiness in the heart lingers, doesn't it? Events, when we bond together, they have a kind of a lasting effect. Joy, God deposits for how long as He wants. One soul that's not depicted as being joy-filled, but utterly was John of the Cross. It's his feast day. He's a doctor of the church. There's not many of them. He wrote four books. Died in 1591, the young age of 49. He was an extraordinary person, filled, as I said, with joy in the spirit. And his life wasn't easy. His dad died at the young age of 7. They were in poverty. They were estranged from their own family. His older brother died from malnutrition. John would always be short because he just didn't get the right vitamins and minerals and food when he should have. Such was their plight in life. And he went off to work in the hospital as an assistant and thought maybe he was called to be a male nurse because he was always thinking of others. He was altruistic, not selfish, not me-focused, but what can I do for others? And he picked that up from his own mother. But eventually God touched his soul and the Jesuits taught him but didn't foster him. He went off and became a Carmelite and was ordained as a monk or a friar in that order. Now, just stop here. Carmelites are what we call contemplatives. They're people who go off to a monastery or a friary and spend much of their life in prayer and penance. And sometimes on the outside, people look at them and say, what a waste. Why bother? It's a little bit like, I suppose, our stained glass windows. Here at St. Pat's, you walk on the outside and they look like dark, foreign, incomprehensible bits of glass stuck up there. They don't seem to make much sense. That's because you're on the outside. If you come on the inside and look in, you can see their beauty and their meaning. So too, contemplatives who spend their life in a monastery might seem to be wasting their time, but don't make that mistake. We have power in this church, we have a microphone functioning, because somewhere outside of Albury is a power station that generates the power for these things to work. So too in the church, the power station, the prayer station that generates all the graces and blessings for the works of mercy, the poor, the needy, the sick, come from the contemplatives. They're our unseen, silent prayers that pour down God's grace, or rather, seek God's grace and blessings for us. And therefore, they're vital, and always have been in the church. John was called to that. And soon after being ordained, he felt discouraged because the order wasn't as strict as he thought it ought to be. It's going to leave, but he bumped into a woman, not physically, but spiritually, who changed his life. And that was Teresa of Avila, big time prime mover in the church. She also the doctor of the church. And she split the Carmelite order into two branches, the strict, discalced, and what was happening back then. And she wanted people like Father John to join, and he did. He changed his name because he would now start to live the cross. In starting a reform of an order, you pick up many enemies. So he took the name John of the Cross. And after founding a monastery, he was kidnapped and placed in a cell in Toledo. It's a tall building, back of a monastery, and the cell was only the size of your bathroom, 6 feet by 10 feet. No plumbing, no toilet, no water, no table, no window. And he spent not 1 week there, but 9 months. He didn't even have a change of clothes. They gave him a bit of bread and water every day. They were trying to break his spirit by crushing his body, but they didn't know who they were mixing with. John of the Cross knew about pleasure, happiness, and joy. And he, through that cross, that suffering, month after month, tapped into the mystical life in a way very few have done in the past or will do in the future. And he summarized his suffering and the insights he was given by God in contemplation in a poem. And it became, in Spanish literature, perhaps one of the greatest poems ever written. When he finally escaped from that cell and took with him his poem, years later he was asked to explain the poem, so he wrote two books called The Ascent of Mount Carmel and The Dark Night of the Soul. He wrote two other books, but I'm going to read just a few excerpts from his Dark Night of the Soul. Chapter 1, which is the explanation of the poem, I'll just give you the first few lines of the poem. He says, one dark night, in other words, my time here in prison, fired with love's urgent longings, God poured grace into my soul. It says, ah, the sheer grace, the power. I went out unseen, not by visible eyes, my house, body, being now all still and calm. The soul was now in joy. In joy, and therefore happiness and pleasure were pulled into line. It says in chapter 1 of the book, in explaining those words, it says, when above a baby is being fed by its mother, the child seeks the mother for nourishment and finds consolation in the mother. But that doesn't last. Nourishment must then come for the body without that sweetness of the mother. Well, so too in prayer. Prayer is nourishment of the soul. Initially, when you start praying, you get consolation from it. It's nice. You feel a closeness to God. But then God decides to wean you from himself so that you love him, not for the consolations you get or the sweetness given, but for his sake alone. So he weans you and dries you. In other words, you don't find pleasure in prayer. You find it difficult and dry. He says, that's normal. That's supernatural. God's saying, grow up. Love me for my sake. not for what you get from me. And he says, as you make progress here, you're entering into the dark night, and then you'll be tempted through the seven vices. He says, you must be warned. They are filled with trouble. Think of a downpipe off a roof when it rains. If the downpipe's blocked, the rain doesn't pass through. So too, there are many obstacles in the vices that block God's grace from penetrating our soul. And he goes through each of these seven vices and begins with pride. He says, people who are called to prayer can be somewhat vain. They want to instruct others rather than be instructed. And often too, they're good people, but they seem to find fault in others. They're holy, but they condemn and detract others whenever the occasion arises. Quoting, seeing the little faults in other people and failing to see the beam and major faults in themselves. Furthermore, these holy Joes, as they increase in grace and prayer, tend to want to advise others rather than being advised. Someone will congratulate them and impress them by their deeds, and they take glory in that rather in God's grace. Furthermore, they make many resolutions, but accomplish very few. Yes, they go to confession, he says, but when they confess what seems favourable, and often they excuse themselves rather than accuse themselves of their misgivings and faults. Furthermore, they become impatient and angry with themselves because they think they should be making more progress when it's God who's doing all the work. It's at his pace we travel. Furthermore, they dislike others being praised because they want to seek the praise themselves. He says, these are all the baggage of pride that we all possess. Get through that. Rather, pull out these obstacles and let the grace flow. He says, we do that by becoming humble. We need to be truly humble, he says, and that means always at the service of others. We should not think to be exalted, but rather exalt God. These people who are humble advance quickly in perfection because they belittle themselves before others. They long to be taught rather than to teach. They want to be instructed rather than go around telling everyone what they need to know. And he goes on to explain how humility is the cornerstone to make progress in prayer. Well, we are blessed in this city. We have an adoration chapel to help us pray. Let us take the insights of such great writers, doctors of the church and mystics like John of the Cross to our prayer and ask his inspiration on this feast day. He suffered much with the cross and through the cross came to find joy of the Spirit. May you too, through your cross and perseverance, partake of that joy. Praise to Jesus Christ.